This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, February 19th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, frustration grows as some communities in Haiti are only now receiving aid more than a month after the earthquake.
I had to find two pickup trucks myself to go down and take the first MREs for this area.
Israeli troops in the West Bank used tear gas and sound bombs to disperse protesters in Berlin. Today's the fifth anniversary of protests against the separation wall. And health insurance companies are jacking up rates. The Obama administration is hitting back. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. NATO forces continue to push ahead with the major offensive in the Afghan city of Marja, despite what a British commander calls stiff resistance. The operation began 7 days ago and involves 15,000 NATO troops and Afghan policemen. 11 NATO soldiers and 3 Afghan police have died. The number of Taliban and civilian casualties is uncertain. The offensive is expected to last another month. The West African state of Niger is once again facing an uncertain political future in the wake of Thursday's military-backed coup. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
The military ousted President Mamadou Tanja on Thursday after months of political instability. Tanja sparked a political crisis last year when he suddenly assumed emergency powers and changed the constitution in an effort to extend his term by 3 years. His action caused outrage in the country and drew international sanctions. Even though the new military rulers are pledging to return Niger to democracy and good governance, the uranium-rich country has a long history of instability. The military-backed coup has drawn criticism from the African Union, former colonial power France, and neighboring Nigeria. The coup in Niger is the fifth in Africa in the last 18 months. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Childhood leukemia rates in the southern Iraqi city of Basra have more than doubled in 15 years. That's according to a study published in the American Journal of Public Health. Researchers used a Basra hospital registry to chart the number of childhood leukemia patients from 1993 to 2007. The leukemia rate in the early years of the study was comparable to those of other countries in the region, but had sharply increased by 2004. The study did not investigate the causes behind the jump in leukemia cases. Basra was widely exposed to depleted uranium during U.S. military actions in 1991 and 2003. Suspected Maoists carried out 2 strikes in India this week, most recently on a village in the state of Bihar. Jasvinder Sehgal reports from India.
The Maoists attacked the village because they suspect the residents were helping police. The rebels burned thatched houses and fired a hail of bullets during the raid, leaving 12 residents dead and 8 others injured. Indian police patrolling just a half mile away were not able to stop the raid. Bihar Police Director General U.S. Dutt says the Maoists planted landmines on the road to the village.
The Naxalites knew that the police is there and would rush to the scene of crime. To delay their arrival, they laid down landmines and they opened fire on the police party.
The villagers are questioning why they weren't given more police protection, even though they have previously been targeted by the Maoists for helping Indian security forces. Jaswinder Sehgal, FSRN, India.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has agreed to pay $1.25 billion to settle a long-standing class action lawsuit brought by black farmers who say the department systematically denied them access to programs and loans that were made available to their white counterparts. The payment of settlements will require a congressional appropriation of funds. A class action lawsuit filed against a Pennsylvania school district alleges the district spied on students by remotely activating webcams embedded in school-issued laptops. FSRN's Andalusia Knoll has more.
When Blake Robbins was called into the assistant principal's office at his high school in suburban Philadelphia for engaging in, quote, inappropriate behavior at home, he became suspicious. His, quote, behavior had been documented through a webcam embedded in his computer that had been remotely activated by the school district. In a public statement, the Lower Merion School District claimed that the remote webcam activation feature serves to locate a laptop in the event it was reported lost, missing, or stolen, and identify its user. The lawsuit claims the school district failed to inform students and parents that the laptops were equipped with this capability. Robin's parents are suing the school district, the school board, and superintendent for violating numerous privacy and communication laws, as well as a section of the Civil Rights Act and Fourth Amendment. The class action suit could include 1,800 other students and their families. The school district says it has deactivated the remote tracking security feature in student laptops and will not use it again without written notification to students and families. Andalusia Null, FSRN, Philadelphia.
In Mexico, the activist accused of killing indie media reporter Brad Will has been released from prison for lack of evidence. Juan Manuel Martinez Moreno was active in a political opposition movement in the municipality where Brad Will was fatally shot in October of 2006. Martinez Moreno spent 16 months in a state penitentiary without bail as part of his pretrial detention. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
This is Doreen Marina in New York. All over the West Bank, Israeli troops use tear gas and sound bombs to suppress nonviolent anti-wall protests. Today, people of Belin, a small Palestinian village in central West Bank, marked the fifth-year anniversary of their weekly struggle against the Israeli-built wall on their lands. And once again, protesters were met with tear gas. FSRN's Ghassan Banora reports.
After the midday prayers at the local mosque in Bel'in, villagers along with international and Israeli supporters marched towards the Israeli-built wall. In 2004, the International Court of Justice in The Hague ruled the Israeli wall illegal. In September 2007, the villagers continued to protest, and the legal proceedings managed to get the Israeli Supreme Court of Justice to order a halt to the wall construction. The court ruled for a rerouting of the wall section built on Bel'in's land. Due to the ruling, the villagers got back 275 of the 600 acres Israel was going to use to build the wall. This week, after 2 years of stalling, the Israeli military started to reroute the wall as ordered by the court. Iyad Burnat, head of the Bel'in Committee Against the Wall and Settlements.
The creative ideas of the local popular committee against the wall, along with Berlin residents resisting the wall, attracted a lot of international supporters and media attention, which helped to spread information about this issue.
Since the start of Bel'in village protest 5 years ago, Israeli and international supporters have joined the residents' struggle. Shai Pollack is an Israeli activist who comes to Bel'in every week.
In the beginning, the first role of the Israelis was to try to lower the amount of violence from the army, because the army have different open fire orders. If they are like only Palestinians, it's very, very dangerous. And then, of course, after many years of working together, there are like other issues, like we are building like a movement of a joint struggle, the struggle against the wall and the occupation generally.
Villages all over the West Bank followed Bel'in's steps in conducting weekly protests against the Israeli-built wall on their lands. Salah Al-Khawaja is from the nearby Na'lin village, where anti-wall protests started 3 years ago.
There were three key elements that succeeded in Bel'in: continuity, diversity, and self-dependence, which Na'lin, Al-Mazra, and Susiga had learned from.
Over the past 6 months, the Israeli military has arrested at least 128 villagers from all over the West Bank in connection to the weekly anti-wall protests. Currently, Israel's army is holding at least 6 members of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements under charges of incitement against the military. Iyad Burnat, head of the Bel'in Committee Against the Wall and Settlements.
They try to stop us by force. by nightly invasions and arrests. They even tried to kill people, and they did. They killed our friend Bazmi in April of last year to try to stop this weekly activity. We say that our protests will continue, and we will not stop until the wall is gone.
Every week, an Israeli army unit stops the villagers from going through the gate of the wall by firing tear gas canisters, causing dozens to suffer tear gas inhalation. Today, at least three residents were injured by rubber-coated steel bullets. Dozens more were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. The army also used liquid tear gas. This Friday, the protest ended at the village of Bel'in, but before dispersing, the villagers gave a final look at the tombstone of Basim Abu Rahma, a local popular resistance activist killed by Israeli tear gas fire last year. In total, the army has injured 1,200 people from the village during the weekly protests started 5 years ago. Ghassan Bannoura, Afasaran, Bel'in village.
While covering today's protests, Israeli troops shot Ghassan in the head with a tear gas canister. He had to seek treatment at a local clinic. He has a minor concussion, but he says he's doing fine. More than a month after the Haitian earthquake, many communities outside of Port-au-Prince are only now receiving aid. And with heavy rains this week, shelter is more urgent than ever. One of those communities is in the Beautelier Mountains, south of Port-au-Prince. The first aid delivery since the earthquake arrived today, and witnesses said an estimated 2,000 people gathered. FSRN spoke with Glenna Stinson with Trees for Life International, a group that focuses on community development in Haiti. She's been living and working in Haiti for 20 years and has been in Beautelier Mountain since before the earthquake. She said that the trucks came with 30 armed guards from MINUSTAH. She began by describing her repeated efforts to request aid from relief organizations over the past 4 weeks.
Well, I went down about the eighth day after the earthquake. I went down to what they're calling the UN camp. And inside the camp, there's organizations from all over the world living in tents and in, the prefab offices. That was the eighth day after the earthquake. They finally called me. This is the delivery I believe we have today, but it's not food. So I had to keep going back down, and when I realized that I was not going to get anything from the designated organizations, I have a friend who is with an organization called Hope for Haiti. I told him we haven't gotten anything, the people don't have anything, we only have three tarps, we have no food delivery. He made sure that his organization sent us up some rice and beans and some cookies. And that, so what these people have received since the earthquake is 292 cartons of MREs and about enough for maybe 100 families of rice and beans and cookies. No tents, no clothing, nothing. And these are people who actually their houses are flattened. They have no home to go back to. So as many as 100 people are sharing one tarp.
Let's talk about that for a moment. There has been rains coming during this past week. The rainy season is approaching. What's the situation like as far as shelter?
Well, where I am, there's no shelter. There's only three tarps that are being shared by about 300 people. I went down last week. And I finally found an organization called ShelterBox. Before ShelterBox was doing the distribution, that's where the first tents got distributed, but there weren't enough for all the people. Then the government announced they were not going to be doing any more tent distribution or shelter distribution. My memory is that that was about 2 weeks after the earthquake.
So today is the first day that you've received tents for people there.
What we're getting today is only tarps.
Okay.
These are plastic tarps. That's all we're getting. And they're giving two to each family. I think they brought up enough for 500 families. So they will be getting some kind of plastic tarp to do something with. But it's not going to give them the kind of shelter from the rains that a tent would give them.
And you said there are around 500 people up until now who's been sharing three tarps. What is that like? What kind of protection does that offer people?
Well, they got the tarp overhead, and then they're lining the sides of the tarp with sheets and material. So it's not giving them any shelter. So I have to say, from my own perspective, sir, this is the most inhumane response to a disaster that I could imagine. I can't imagine how the people that I've seen the people living in shelters that they're just making themselves, and I go down to the compound and I see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of trucks and vehicles that are not in use. I see tons and tons of aid packages that are not being delivered. Sir, I do not understand it myself. I cannot comprehend it. I've talked to people in charge.
What have they told you? Why are those trucks there and aid there that's not being used? What have they said?
They told me the last time I was down there, they told me they were too afraid to go out into the population. And I've been here 20 years. And the perception of, there's a perception through the media that I believe creates an image that the Haitian people are violent and fight and hurt, and it's not true. When they've waited 2 or 3 weeks for just water, yes, they're going to storm the trucks for water after they've had to wait so long. Yes, that's the way they are doing. But they told me that they were afraid to take the vehicles out into the streets and start doing whatever they're supposed to be doing with these trucks. So I had to find 2 pickup trucks myself to go down and take the first MREs for this area. And I asked them, could you deliver? They said, no, ma'am, we can't deliver. You have to pick it up.
Glenna Stinson is with Trees for Life International. She joined us by phone from Beautellier Mountain, just south of Port-au-Prince. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dorian. Thank you very much, too.
Healthcare reform may be stalled in Congress, but healthcare costs are moving full steam ahead. The Obama administration has sharply criticized WellPoint Insurance for jacking up their rates, but they're not the only ones charging more for premiums. Consumer outrage at the rate increases may be just what the Democrats need to get reform moving again. Tanya Snyder reports.
People around the country have seen their premiums go up year after year. Sami Ambar, an out-of-work banker from New York City, says his HMO premiums just went up by 35%.
Even before this year, the premiums were doubling every 4 years. Now, my HMO has just been increased by 35% to $1,177 a month, which is $14,000 a year.
Ambar says he complained to the New York State Insurance Commissioner, who said he has no power to control rate increases. Ambar is in the ranks of millions of healthcare consumers who are finding it harder and harder to afford their monthly premiums. He gets his insurance through Aetna. Earlier this month, Anthem Blue Cross in California announced that it would raise insurance premiums by as much as 39% for its individual policyholders. That lit a fire under Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius.
A lot of these customers have no choice. Their really only choice is either pay the increased rates or drop the coverage. They don't have a shopping place to visit.
That shopping place is the insurance exchange proposed in the Senate health reform bill, which narrowly passed Christmas Eve, but still hasn't gone to conference, where lawmakers will work out the differences with the House bill. Scott Brown's Senate victory in Massachusetts sucked the momentum out of health reform, and Democrats haven't been able to regroup. Sebelius says the insurance company's cries of economic necessity just don't ring true. WellPoint, which operates Anthem in California and Blue Cross plans in 13 other states, has more members than any other commercial insurer in the country. Sebelius says they're doing just fine.
WellPoint alone posted a $2.7 billion profit in the fourth quarter of 2009, just a week before they filed for a 39% rate increase.
Sebelia sent a letter to Anthem asking them to justify the rate increase, and yesterday the department released a report called Insurance Companies Prosper, Families Suffer. But WellPoint spokesperson and strategist Brad Flugel disputes the part about insurance companies prospering.
The reason that the premiums are going up as rapidly as they are is that the underlying costs are going up that much. The rate of medical inflation for this population accounts for about half of the average increase.
He says the other half of the increase in costs is due to healthy people dropping their insurance coverage altogether because of the difficult economy and undoubtedly due to the skyrocketing costs of the premiums.
The people that are leaving tend to be much healthier than the people that are staying, which means that the costs for those that remain on average are significantly higher.
WellPoint executive Brian Sassy made the same points in the letter he sent to Sebelius in response to her demand for an explanation. In a way, Anthem is playing right into the administration's agenda. As Sebelius and Obama see it, the company is proving their point that costs will continue to skyrocket without reform. Ron Pollock of Families USA, a nonprofit healthcare advocacy group, says Anthem's actions help illustrate the cost of doing nothing.
Yes. Healthcare costs are rising, but nowhere near these record increases in premiums. And so there's obviously a lot of profit making that's taking place. And while it's very important to make sure that the healthcare system is much more efficient and less costly, and health reform would help to achieve that, these premium increases really are way out of line.
WellPoint officials disagree. Although reform would broaden their base of clients, especially healthy clients, their studies show premiums will go up even more under reform. Meanwhile, it all may have gotten too out of hand for people like Sami Ambar. He says if his insurance premiums keep rising at this rate, he may have to leave the country. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
A coalition of civil rights leaders and economists is criticizing the Obama administration's job creation strategy and calling on congressional leaders to focus on the needs of poor people and people of color in the economic recovery. The NAACP, the National Council of La Raza, the Center for Community Change, and the Economic Policy Institute are some of the groups that sent a letter today to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. They highlighted recommendations that they say focus on the needs of local communities, such as extending unemployment insurance and COBRA benefits through the end of the year, and increasing investment in the infrastructure of schools and public transit. The letter also calls for immediate action to stop foreclosures. Ben Jealous, president of the NAACP, said that black communities have been feeling the effects of the recession for years now.
Black folks in this country are hurting right now, but the reality is that we were hurting 2 years ago. We were hurting 3 years ago. We were in a recession in many parts of this country, like Detroit and Harlem, that had been going on for 40 years, and now it has deepened. And so as we come out of it, we want to make sure that the tide lifts all boats, and that those tides and those boats that had they were sinking a bit lower are restored fully.
The civil rights leaders spoke to reporters today on a teleconference. Also involved is Janet Murguia, president of the National Council of La Raza. She pointed to figures that demonstrate the dire need of Latino communities. She said more than 1 million Latino families will lose homes to foreclosure before 2011, and 2 million Latinos and blacks have lost jobs since the recession began.
1 year after President Obama signed the Recovery Act, the unemployment rate for Latinos is 12.6%. nearly 3 points higher than for the nation overall. In some industries with a large Latino presence, like construction, 1 in 5 workers is unemployed. The majority of Latinos live in states where budget gaps exceed 20% of the state's general fund.
Last week, Obama met with the NAACP's Jealous, Al Sharpton, and the National Urban League's Mark Morial to discuss chronic unemployment in the black community. And earlier this week, leaders spoke out against the Recovery Act, neglecting people of color and women. Today, Wade Henderson, president of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, called their new recommendations big, bold action. He pointed to President Obama's announcement today of increased aid for homeowners. Henderson said he welcomed the move, but it didn't go far enough for the needs of homeowners facing imminent foreclosure. Lawmakers are in their home districts this week, and immigrant rights advocates are using the chance to bring attention to immigration reform. Rallies were planned in San Francisco, Colorado, and Cincinnati, Ohio. Many advocates support the bill of Congressmember Luis Gutierrez, the Comprehensive Immigration Reform for America's Security and Prosperity Act. The bill includes the DREAM Act, which would allow young immigrants who meet certain requirements the opportunity to enlist in the military or go to college. It could also provide a path to citizenship. Many young immigrants have been trying to raise awareness of the DREAM Act, including a group in Siler City, North Carolina, a small town where the Latino population makes up nearly 40% of the community. Here, high school students organized an art show with a local chapter of Reform Immigration for America. Called the Dream Walk, the exhibit depicts the students' dreams for higher education through their use of photography. FSRN's Linda Marie Taurasi spoke to students and advocates at the event for this edition of Street Beat.
My name is Oscar Aviles. I'm from Siler City, North Carolina. It sort of brings us down that people are opposed to our goal and our dreams. And if people were to get the information, find out about the immigration reform, and it's a good thing, not a bad thing. If they were just to support it, we would already have achieved our goal.
My name is Wu-Tin Goff, and I'm from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I want to see it passed for many reasons, mainly because it would help the economy a lot, because what we have right now with the naturalization system, it's so hard to achieve citizenship that people can't do it. Like, it takes 17 years and thousands of dollars when, you know, we have families that have kids that need to eat tonight and whatnot. But when this pathway is shortened, like, you know, people can actually do it, people are going to get their license and buy cars and buy car insurance and then go to college and study to see families. And all this money is just going to blow into the economy and basically save it. A lot of the opposition that we're facing have misleading information on why they don't approve immigration reform. There's many myths, like one that immigrants don't pay taxes, and that's completely untrue. Besides sales tax and taxes that you pay if you own and rent an apartment or house, like, there's this thing called the individual taxification identification number, and that's exactly the same thing as social security number, but for people that don't have social security, and actually some American citizens use that instead of social security also.
Adrian Romero from Mexico City. Several decades, it's just been like the promise or the argument that it's going to change, but nothing happens. Something comes up, like the war or health reform or something, and it's about time for immigration to have its chance to change. It's like a delicate topic, so a lot of people want to avoid it. They go, we'll handle it later.
Ronald Garcia Fogarty, I'm the executive director of the Hispanic Liaison in Siler City, North Carolina. One of the things that we want to see happen is the youth, you know, need access to higher education. We have a lot of our leadership here in Siler City and Pittsburgh are young leaders, and this dream walk that we're doing was created a lot by their own stories, their own photographs, their own art, you know, and they're really, you know, passionate about, you know, access in higher education. That's their future. And they're very bright students, they're, you know, top in their class, but they are limited in their possibilities to access higher education. I mean, the reform needs to happen at the national level. You know, it needs to be passed by the Senate, it needs to be passed by the House of Representatives. And in the past, it's been close to passing, but it hasn't passed. And so we're hoping that this year we can get enough votes in the House, in the Senate. And, of course, the president has said that his intent is to sign immigration reform as well.
That segment was recorded and produced by FSRN's Linda Marie Taurasi. And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi, Scott Pham, and Oscar Hernandez. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.